Eric.
Hey, Charles. How are you doing?
Good. We're in the clouds today, man.
Yes, we're in the clouds. Well, not only literally, but really, right? We're here with Amitabh today.
All right.
And talk about Azure. And so maybe you can also scan a little bit there. Look at there, the kind of, you know, the red dog.
Red dog.
The exterminator.
Exactly.
Whoa.
All the stuff we saw at PDC.
Yes.
So what's the story behind those shoes?
I think this started off more as I think it was the Christmas party in my home, and you know, Dave kind of like gets the shoes done at there's a NikeID.com where you can actually design these shoes, and he actually designs his own shoes, and we were thinking about like, you know, what should we get? Like, everybody gets caps and jackets and things like that. Mm-hmm. And Dave's idea was, hey, like, why don't we get Red Dog shoes? and he was there, like, you know, came in and he designed the one with the yellow stripe one. That's the one which was the original one which Dave designed. And then we basically opened it up for a contest. Mm-hmm. So there were 12 designs submitted for the shoes there, and you know, and a democratic process was there. And my logic is democracy doesn't work.
Democratic democracy.
But it sort of like we picked a shoe and then everybody got it, and it just kind of like became our, you know, like a Red Dog big feature of it. So only it was limited edition, so we just ordered. They were very expensive too, so it wasn't very easy to buy them, but everybody on the team basically had one.
No, that's cool. That's much better than t-shirts. I mean,
absolutely.
Yeah, plus, there's apparently, you know, once you have a t-shirt, your project fails. So your shoes are safer. You know? There's no jinx. So can you tell us a little bit about Red Dog? Kind of, you know, what's the kind of, you know, the 10,000 foot picture of that?
Yeah, and so let me kind of like first define what cloud means, because the word cloud is like used so loosely, and everybody has a different meaning attached to it, and we sort of like, and whatever I'm going to define it, that's not, it's accepted universally by anything, but we have a sort of like a more precise definition of it. So we view the cloud as a massive geo-distributed computer. Okay, so think of it as a massive computer which consists of disks, racks, switches, load balancers, you know, distributed across the globe. You know, it's this massive geo-distributed computer. Our approach to the cloud is that we want to go build an operating system which manages this massive geo-distributed computer. And for that, it owns all the resources on the computer. So it can allocate them very efficiently. And then it also automates majority of the things that, you know, you do for managing the life cycle of anything that runs on it. That's what an operating system does. Mm-hmm. By doing both of those things, we can drive the cost down, both the CapEx and the OpEx, which is the capital expenses and the operational expenses. The second thing it does is it hides all this complexity that you get by in this massive scale-out computer that we've got. And it presents a rich set of abstractions. So now, if you're developing a service, you actually don't have to worry about all this complexity, and you can program to those set of abstractions. So you can develop your services faster and take them to the market in as short a time as possible. So the second, you know, one is cost, and the second big goal is agility.
Okay, so when you talk about like programming this kind of computer, do you kind of, you know, is the view that programmers get is that of one computer, or is it like, you know, So do I abstract from locality and everything?
Yes.
Is that the idea?
So there are two ways we can answer this question. One part is that we have been very careful to make sure that the programming model or the programming tools or the programming languages are the same that exist on our platform. So you still use .NET frameworks, you know, Win32s, Visual Studio, the same full scope of the, you know, the rich set of Microsoft tools that we have offered, you can still use, or you can use any other programming languages mm-hmm. you want. So that aspect still remains the same. The second aspect that comes out is not because of anything we have done, but it's the fact that this is a very, very distributed environment. This is a scale-out environment. So when you're writing an application for the distributed application, you have to follow the certain principles or guidelines as you will write for a distributed app. For example, you know, it's good to write stateless apps, right? I mean, there is, because machines are going to fail and things go away. So if you are, if your state is persistent, then you don't have to worry about it. I mean, you can die, we will bring you up on another node, but things will just work as there. So there is a mental shift that you have to make, but that's just a shift that you have to make. That's nothing because of us, but it's just because it's going to be true on any distributed platform.
Okay, and so you said, I really like that, you know. I don't know, do you know this book, The Change Function?
Yes.
So that, I mean, you're kind of, you know, doing exactly the right thing, right? It's like, you know, accessing kind of customer pain with least pain of adoption.
So, that's right.
So I think, you know, nothing can go wrong there. But you know, talking about, like, you know, the kind of, you know, the difference that you said, right? So we are going to a more distributed world.
That's correct.
So, do you see any kind of particular challenges there for programmers, and did you kind of address those?
Absolutely. The one part that, like you said, like we have been trying to be very careful on the fact to make sure that your skills transfer,
yep.
And that's so that the change is as minimal as possible. The second element that you get out is the shift in the, because majority of the applications that have been written for the enterprise, for example, they're all scale up,
yeah,
right, and they rely on the fact that there's a disk which will be there, you know, if you write anything to the registry, it is going to be there. So they have this transient state, and it sort of like stays away. When you're going to the distributed world, you know, a lot of those things sort of like go away.
Yep.
There is no concept of printfs. There is no monitors into the system. Debugging has to be thought in a different way, because if you have an application running on thousands of nodes and everybody's logging data, the log data gets into like gigabytes, like
yep.
in a very. So we provide lots and lots of different tools that can scale to this to this level of. So the big shift that people will see is basically is going to be the issue of scale, and the same tools that they have been used to in the past, can they will they be applicable? And some of the things will come down to them to really go back and say, have they really thought it through while they're developing a sort of like a scale-out application per se? So one aspect is that, yes, will an application which was running there, can it run on the cloud? The answer is yes, modulo some of those changes if you are not writing to local disk or whatever. But if you want to really utilize the full power of the cloud, you can write to the local, you know, registry or local disk, it'll work. But if it dies and your application gets moved to another node, that may not work very well. But these applications can work well. So if you're really trying to utilize the full power of the cloud and you want to help us manage your app so that we can take a lot of the burden away, then the more you write these apps as stateless apps, the more you think about the large scale that how you are going to debug your application, how do you log, what kind of data you log. One of the examples I gave everybody is like, you know, you've got thousands of nodes which are running very quickly, and you're logging the data or your application very quickly. The logs get into gigabytes and gigabytes of logs all over the place. Mm. It's not practical, you know, like traditional ways, like, hey, get all the logs here and then go back and do it. It doesn't work.
Mm-hmm.
You really need something like a distributed grep or something like that to really correlate the logs so that you can look at time slices across those mechanisms that are there. So a lot of these things have to be evolved and really, you know, like thought through in the distributed space.
And so you said, like, you know, that programmers, you know, they have to kind of, you know, maybe communicate to the system such that they can, you know, the system can kind of optimize, you know, running their application. Is there some kind of some way that, you know, I can give metadata or something about my app such that you can kind of manage it better?
Absolutely, absolutely. And the way we do that is that when you provide your service to be running on Windows Azure, we basically, you provide us two pieces of information. One is the code of your service, and the second thing which we call is the service model, which is the metadata for your service. And what the service model provides is the architecture of your service. How are the various front ends? How are they connected to the back ends? What are the switches, load balancers? How they look at? So you describe the service for us. How many instances of each role do you need? What are the configuration settings you want? So there is a service model you basically define, and you give it to us. So what we do is we look at your code, we look at the service model, which defines the architecture of your service, and then we follow what you said to set it up. And now, once we understand the architecture of your service, we can handle all the things for you, like, you know, which is the one that we have heard a lot from our customers, like, if an OS needs to be upgraded, can I upgrade the OS without bringing your service down? We can do that automatically for you, mm-hmm. Automatically. So we can manage all the upgrades, the deployments, if a node goes down, because we know in the service model you said, hey, I want 5 front ends. So if one front end is down, it's our job to make sure we give you another one to make sure your steady state is 5.
Okay.
So once we understand of how your architecturally your service is organized, we know, so it's kind of like a finite state machine. So basically, whatever the current state is, we know this is the state you want the application to be in. We just make the right transitions to get you to that particular state.
So as a kind of programming language person, you know, I'm interested, like, so is there any way you kind of check that model against the code? I mean, is it like types where, you know, you say it's an integer, but really it's a bool. So yeah. Is there any kind of checking that
I think it's at a different level. The service model is a kind of like at a different level, because the code is the, if you look at the code that you provide, is the code that runs inside a role. So the service model is at a kind of like at an architecture level above that.
Okay.
So you're basically saying, you know, the only thing that you can verify are that in the service model you do specify what the endpoints are, or who can talk to each other, and that can be that we will enforce.
Okay.
That we can enforce that if you say these two roles are supposed to talk through a switch, we will organize that way. Or these two roles are not supposed to talk to each other. So even if they want to talk together, we won't allow that. So the fabric controller will make sure that if this guy asks for a port to talk to, or an endpoint to talk to a particular one, that we won't let him talk. So some of those things we can enforce. So as much of the architecture that you specify, that anything that is enforceable, we try to enforce that.
Okay, so that's very nice. And so how do you describe that architecture? Is there a special kind of language to describe that?
So the way we have done is ultimately, by the time it comes to us, it's an XML file.
Okay.
It's an XML file. So we kept it like a very simple XML file. So you can actually use any tool, I mean really any tool, or even domain-specific languages. So, for example, one of the languages could be Oslo, for example.
Yes, yeah.
Right? I mean, our own modeling languages. Or people could come up with their own graphic, you know, drawing tools or whatever. As long as whatever the front end is, whatever the user works with, but ultimately it translates it back to the XML file and we just we just consume the XML file.
Sure.
Yeah. And so another question there is, like, you know, this modeling there, is it... Can you kind of, you know, you said, like, you know, you can use that when you upgrade the operating system, but can that model also kind of, you know, evolve dynamically? So imagine that, you know, I define my architecture now. I say, you know, I want to kind of change that.
Yes.
So is that possible?
You can modify the service model at any time. There are two elements that come out. One is that if you change the service if you reorganize the service model, that you reorganize the roles and things like that, depending upon how big the change is, we may have to redeploy the service to do that. The other type of change comes in is for the fact that you may just be changing the number of instances you want, which is a more common phenomenon. Yeah. Like people come back and say, look, I want to go and have 10 front-end instances or, you know, so many back-end roles, but I, you know, that they can change that. For that, you don't even have to specify in the service model. They have a special, you know... APIs, or which will have ultimately APIs, or even their configuration settings that you can specify how to modify that.
Wow, that sounds much better than kind of, you know, messing around with the real machines.
It is, and this was the big change that we when we were starting this project. You know, even though Microsoft has been doing services we've been doing services for over 10 years. You know, and we've got so many data centers and over 200 services running inside the company. And the question that we were figuring out was that a lot of the people, they view the cloud as just offer cheap compute and cheap storage. Okay. Mm-hmm. And that's it. Okay. And the question comes back is, if you talk to the customers, and we have large enterprise business and a lot of web developers that are there, that clearly they want that. I mean, they want cheap compute and commodity storage. They want that, and they want the scale and every aspect of that. But then the story doesn't stop there. There's a huge amount of cost that they have to bear. When if you look at the total cost of ownership, is based on the fact that they have to maintain it, they have to upgrade it, they have to deploy it, they have to monitor it. Mm-hmm. If something goes down, then they have to figure out, there's a huge amount of factors that amount of energy and money that is spent in managing a lot of those elements out is extremely, extremely high. And that is why, instead of just providing compute and storage in the cloud, we took an operating system-based approach. And the goal was not just provide a virtualized compute and a scalable storage system, but also provide, along with it, the full management capability so that it manages the entire life cycle of your service, end-to-end, so that the users can benefit from that. And that is why we added the fact that you have to give us a service model. Because for us to be able to do that, we have to understand the architecture of your service. And once we understand the architecture of your service, then we can do what you want.
Yes.
It's not like we're making it up. I mean, we're still doing exactly what you want, but you have told us what you want, and then we can do it in an organized way so that you can always get to the same end state that you really want to get at.
Excellent. Yeah. I think that's a kind of amazing thing. That is kind of, in some sense, it took a while before we kind of really apply computing to itself, right?
That's right.
Where now suddenly, things that required manual labor, we can now automate and apply the same techniques as, we do when we write code. So I really like the kind of, recursion, so to speak.
Yes.
Yeah. So another question is, like, when we're talking about the programs that you write, right, that behind the services, are they in, is that managed code or unmanaged code, or does that matter?
They can be in any language. So when we opened it up at PDC, we started off with managed code. We first started off PDC at managed code. At Mix, we allowed native code, full trust. Mm-hmm. And essentially, you can write in any language, because by the time it comes to us, it's a binary. It has to be a Windows program. As long as it runs on Windows, but you can write in any language you want to.
And then let's go deeper into the system.
Yeah.
So what kind of technology do you use to kind of run all these things?
Yes. So we use a hypervisor. All of our nodes are virtualized. All our compute nodes are virtualized. So we have a very efficient hypervisor. It's a next generation of Hyper-V. So we have have optimized it for the data center environment. We take and the design point we basically chose was there are certain advantages you get in a data center. It's a homogeneous environment. Okay, you have control over what hardware people are going to run at. And so the approach we took was, like, let's just go and assume that we're going to buy hardware which is going to have hardware support for virtualization. It's a nice, thing to happen. If you have hardware support for virtualization, you can actually implement a very, very, very efficient hypervisor. Things like nested page table support, for example. So we have taken that route of, utilizing the advances in the hardware. So we will not run, for example, on an old hardware, for example. But in a data center, why would you want to go buy old hardware anyway?
Sure.
Because the latest hardware is there. So it's a fine design point. So we're using that, and we have a virtualized. So every node or any server that we have got is basically virtualized. So we run everything inside VMs, and then we can allocate these VMs. To allocate and manage the whole thing, we have got what we call is a fabric controller. That's the second piece. The first one is the hypervisor, which provides all the computation capability. The second one we have is the fabric controller, and its job is to really manage the life cycle of your service. So he's the one who consumes the service model. He's the one who understands the architecture of your service. He also understands the whole topology of the data center. Mm. So then he can go back and efficiently map your requirements to what the resources in the data center are. So for example, he can come back and say, okay, I want 5 front-end nodes, I want load balancer here, and this is how it is all connected. He will figure out what is the best way to give these guys the resources. And when you need more, he will go and connect them in the proper way. And he is also responsible for all the updates and all those things that are there. One of the things that I mentioned to you that we thought a lot about how do you do upgrades and deployment very carefully. If you remember, on Saturday mornings, you go to this bank site and it says down for maintenance for 3 hours,
yeah.
come back at noon. And our logic is that if a service is running on the cloud, the service should not go down. Availability of the service should not go down, even if you're updating the OS or the service itself. Okay, I mean,
sounds like magic.
So the way we do that is that, look, if you look at it, that we have this notion, the Fabric Controller has this notion of what we call update domains. So when we are updating it, we only do one update domain at a time. So suppose you have a service which has got 5 front ends. We will run each of the 5 front ends on each of them on a separate update domain. So at any time, we will only take one of them down, update them while 4 of them are still working. So conceptually, we have inside the data center, he has the Fabric Controller has the model of here are the different update domains. So once we know your service and we know, okay, here are 5 instances of the same role, he'll be smart enough to how to distribute them across multiple domains. Excellent. So that when you are updating one at a time, we're not bringing the whole thing down. Same thing with the OS. So we can manage all the upgrades and everything that is happening. The key part that comes out is your role should have more than one instance.
Yes. Yeah.
If your role has one instance, there's nothing we can do. But as long as your role has one instance, we can
more than one.
Yes, we will be fine because we will properly allocate it across the one there. And it's been very useful because we do this all the time because once a month. Windows issues, security patches, right?
Yeah. Yep.
And all our customers, if you want them, they really hate that, right? Because they have to go upgrade it's a lot of work, right? They have to go update it. So we do that thing automatically for you and without your service ever going down.
Interesting.
Yes. But here now, I really like that.
Mm-hmm.
I've like this kind of vision. Imagine that we're going to this world, and now there's like say millions of these kind of processes running around. So do you have something like a garbage collector or something? How do you know that certain services are kind of maybe not maybe somebody has not used that for like a year or something? Do you have any way to kind of do they automatically go to kind of background storage? Or?
So here's the thing the Fabric Controller knows the health of every node because we have a health agent which monitors it and just tells us what exactly. Is this node working or not working? So he knows what nodes are free or what nodes are not free. If somebody wants to run a service and takes a VM and doesn't do much with it,
yeah.
but he keeps paying us money,
it's
fine.
Yes, yeah.
he wants a VM, that's okay. Yeah. We can give it to him and if he doesn't use it, I don't mind.
Yeah.
He might have a very good reason for doing it that way. But if he wants, we will give him all the data. Because in the monitoring data that we can come back, we will provide him the data so he can know that this service is not actually being used very much or how much bandwidth or because remember the model that we are going after, it's a utility-based model. It's a consumption-based model. So that is why we meter everything.
Okay.
Mm-hmm. We meter everything. So we meter what the bandwidth is, how much bandwidth is being used, how much storage is being used, how much compute is being used. So, I mean, we have meters in place to monitor how much is actually being used by every node because that's a method of, really charging back to the service.
Yeah. Because I just have this kind of, with a real machine, you can see it's kind of running and I turn it off. But, now maybe there's like,
You can go back and you say, we have these monitoring built in. We have a couple of mechanisms we provide. We provide monitoring, alerting, logging. Alerting means you can set your alerts. So, for example, you could go back and set an alert that, hey, if my usage goes above some X percent, inform me. You can set certain alerts on. We can inform you when, certain thresholds are crossed. So we will have alerting mechanisms. We have monitoring mechanisms. So you can look at what the usage or how your service is behaving. We can give lots of data. Plus, the other thing is, we provide logging mechanisms. So when you're running your service, you can log your own information. Because there is only some things we understand because we really don't understand the architecture of your service.
Yeah.
So we can provide the information at much more base level, but not at the higher level concept. So suppose somebody's running a mail server, he might want to be able to monitor like how many mails were sent or how many mails were received. But he can do that himself by creating these logs and writing them, and then we provide mechanisms for them to bring the logs up and get them.
I think it's wonderful. It's really, I mean, kind of, you know, making the, you know, kind of software or kind of machines into something that, you know, other software can kind of deal with. I think that that's extremely powerful. Mm-hmm. Yeah. And so another question is, like, you know, we talked a lot about the kind of computing, there's also storage.
Yes,
right?
So that's why I'd gone to two. I did compute, and then I sidetracked into fabric controller, and then I forgot about storage.
Storage, yes.
Yeah, my storage guys are going to kill me. So the way we have gotten, we provide is basically, is think of our storage as the equivalent of, like, in a regular operating system, you have a file system. In cloud, you have a distributed file system. And we provide basically blobs, tables, and it's a layered architecture. So we have what we call streams underneath it. And then on top of that, we have built blobs and tables. The storage is designed for scale. So whatever you put, it's again using commodity hardware. So they're not these gigantic servers with like hundreds of disks on them. It's commodity hardware. And we try to distribute the data across many machines all over the data center so that you can do parallel reads. So that it's not like just one. Suppose there's a hot part that you are just everybody's hammering this one node, but your data is distributed across many machines, so we can get very high IOPS, for example. The second thing that we do is that if we have if you have partitioned it in a way that is not the exact one, the system, because of the way the load is working out or the way the access patterns are doing it, the storage system automatically load balances itself and redistributes and repartitions itself so that to get the right load to be happening. That's a very, 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 very strong feature that we have got, because a lot of systems provide the basic storage, but that element, most of the people that if you look at a lot of the systems that we have seen, especially the Web 2.0 apps, you know, whether you're doing with videos and photos and things like that, one aspect that they need is just scalable storage.
Yep.
That's one aspect they need. Mm. The second thing that comes out is that if the nodes are getting hammered in a certain way, how do you repartition and load balance in a way so that your response times and your latencies are still within the piece there? And a lot of these sites have to go build some of those things themselves. And those aspects of adaptive load balancing, adaptive replication, and things like that, since we have already built it inside the storage system, we can automatically balance itself so that we can, you know, we can get the efficiency out. The storage system is designed to be fault tolerant. We keep three replicas of every particular, you know, every storage item which is there. And it's very efficient. I mean, and so we provide blobs, and then we provide tables, which is kind of like a semi-structured store. You know, you get some aspects of keeping the metadata going along with the unstructured data that you've got.
And so for programmers, do you also give like, you know, traditional kind of file kind of, you know, view on top of that?
Since we are built on kind of like on files, I mean, you can use files per se. The only thing is because the files notion is because there's no concept of a local disk. I mean, there is we provide a local disk, but it's not durable. So one of the concepts that we are adding, I shouldn't talk. We haven't announced it.
Hey, but that's okay.
That's fine. Yeah.
So let's move
this
on.
Happens all the time. Yeah.
Yes. But Eric.
Okay.
But your boss, Eric, has created that pretty interesting .NET or SQL data services, which is one of the
master
services.
Yes. I was going to go back. Yes. To that. So the thing that I talked about what was in Windows Azure was think of it as a distributed file system. Okay, so the way we look at in the Azure on an Azure platform, we provide a continuous stream of various storage abstractions that a user is going to need. So you start off from like what I said was like blobs and tables. These are sort of like on the more like the distributed file system. Then we have we want, which very large number of properties want, is a full relational database in the cloud.
Mm-hmm. Yep.
And And there are two approaches that we are taking over there. One is that we're calling it, I'm not sure exactly the name, it was called Database as a Service, but I thought it's also called SDS now, so yeah. SQL Data Services. So one of the two, but essentially I can still tell you what it is.
Sure.
Yeah. And the essential idea is that if you look at the SQL, you know, the SQL services or the database that you've got, a lot of the headache comes out is managing the SQL Server itself. And the big approach that the SQL group is taking by offering this as a service is that they want to take the whole of the managing of the SQL Server out, okay? Mm-hmm. And so now you can still use the full functionality of a relational database without the overhead of having to manage a SQL Server per se. And that is the continuous stream that you basically go back and get. So an app which is being written on top of our Azure Services platform, it gets compute, gets this, it gets the full relational database, and then the next one, which I should talk about, is what we call the .NET services. Mm-hmm. Okay. And these are a bunch of services that we have got is, and that if you look at it, our view of the enterprise is that it's not going to be an either-or option. It's not like there is an on-premises or either-or a cloud.
Yeah.
Okay. We view the cloud as an extension of the on-premise. So there are going to be a large class of apps which people are going to run on-premise. They're never going to go away. Mm-hmm. I mean, that's how it is, whether it's data they need, the configurations they need, compliance they need, for lots of variety of reasons. I mean, there's a long list of reasons why a certain class of apps are going to be running over there. But on the other hand, our Microsoft's approach is that we want to give our on-premises customers the choice to extend some of their applications to the cloud in a very, very seamless way. So when they extend into the cloud, for example, they don't want to work with two separate sets of identity. They want, you know, one federated identity,
yep.
Right? They want to have a secure service bus so that they can talk in a secure way between the cloud and on-premise. Mm. So what .NET Services does, it has a bunch of these services which facilitates on-premises applications to work seamlessly with the cloud in a much, much simpler way. So we have a bunch of services there. Then we have, it's a comprehensive platform. And the thing I should really emphasize is that even though I'm giving you lots of services, it's not a monolithic platform. You know, a user has full power to pick and choose anything he wants to, or use something different. If any of the stuff that we are providing doesn't meet the needs, they can use anything that is there, or use their own, or use third party. We don't care. The whole goal is to really provide customers with choice and to give them, you know, as comprehensive a platform as we can.
And so can you kind of, you know, and I would like to kind of drill a little bit more into these services. So because that, I think, is a very compelling kind of picture that you draw, right, where, you know, it's kind of not either or. You want to have, like, you know, this kind of smooth, you know, transition, yes, where you kind of do the dial. Maybe some apps are all kind of, you know, in the cloud. Yes. Others are all on premises. So is there kind of, you know, what kind of services, like you said, identity and... Yes. But is there also, like, can I imagine that I kind of mount my kind of disk as, you know, as something that's on the cloud?
And those are some of the things that we are working on. That's where I stopped by not pre-announcing something.
Sure.
But yeah, I mean, those are the things that I'll speak at a higher level.
That's fine.
To do that. The essential point that you come out is that you want to make the cloud and the on-premises as seamless as possible. I mean, that's our fundamental intent. The first way we are approaching that is by keeping the programming paradigm, the programming tools, the languages the same. So you don't, if you are programming on the premises, yes, when you go to the cloud, you still use Visual Studio. You still use .NET. Mm-hmm. You still use Win32. So those things are pretty much, so if you are, you don't have to completely learn anything there. Now, the two environments are different. If the on-premises is a scale-up environment, and built with specialized heterogeneous hardware. On this hand, the cloud is homogeneous commodity hardware scale out. So there are fundamental differences also. Mm-hmm. But we can make these be as seamless as possible in both ways. One is keep the programming paradigm as much as the same. Look, the way we look at it is that That's how people call it software plus services, or you call it hybrid clouds. But essentially, it's going to come out. And so one of the things that we are looking at is that the tools that you use, for example, on-premises, like things like System Center and things like that, we want those tools. We don't want a person to use different set of tools, even if they're running on the cloud. So our goal is to really hook those up also with our cloud, so our user is still using the same thing, System Center, for example, of managing both his apps from the cloud. Yeah.
And I would assume that also goes the other way around. I mean, the kind of service model that we talked about, that, you know,
yes.
I could imagine that we see that kind of on the normal.
So a lot of the learnings that we are seeing now, wherever it makes sense, we are moving that all onto the on-premise there, absolutely. And that's why even like in the Hypervisor case or a lot of the things that we have done, wherever it has made sense, we are moving all those learnings or the innovations that we are doing back onto our on-premises product. So our customers, both the places are going to go at a very fast pace, and the goal is to really, you know, improve both of them, because we view both of these are going to be there, and our goal is to, you know, make them be as seamless as possible, advance both of them, and let the customers decide. Because the other one that you come out is that once you have the cloud, it's not about the word I use is that, you know, cloud is only 5 minutes into the first quarter. You know, my analogy that, you know, it's very, very, we are very, very early on. We haven't even seen the new generation of applications. I mean, the social networking is sort of like one of the new classes of apps that have came out, and you see how well it has come. But it's just the beginning. Mm-hmm. So once you provide the customers the choice, like here's on-premise, here's the cloud, and we also have client, and we have also have mobile, and, you know, like Live Mesh is a good example of how we connect a lot of those things out. Let the people innovate. And our job is to provide a very, very general mechanism so that in a general platform, that's why we're taking a much, much more broader general platform approach, just so that not just us, but let our customers innovate, or the developers outside go innovate and come up with new classes of apps, and they will just work and make it as simple and easy for them to develop it and take as much of the complexity away so that they can focus on their application and not on all the grungy details that you've got.
So you mentioned like Live Mesh kind of quickly. Yeah. Can you kind of explain how that kind of, you know, fits into this picture?
So just like, you know, like, yeah, think of it this way, is that you got the hardware, then you've got the operating system, which we call the Windows Azure. And on top of Windows Azure, we have got these various services which makes the platform comprehensive, like SQL services, .NET services, and I'm just going to put Live Mesh as live services. Mm-hmm. These are a set of services which allow a certain class of personal applications to be built, mm-hmm, you know, for a consumer-based applications or whatever you can call it. So think of Live Mesh. I mean, it's got a synchronization layer which goes peer-to-peer, spans the cloud, but also runs on every other device from mobile to class to laptop to servers of the all the classes of applications that you've got. So it's a synchronization layer, and that is why the approach we are taking is not to build a monolithic one, but build it as these layers which are optional pieces which are available. Now, once you have a synchronization one there, then the Live Mesh as an application which synchronizes your files can easily be built on top of it. And that was a new generation of app that came out, and which was very successful.
Yes.
It won, you know, various awards and things like that, and it was a very, very successful app. That sort of like shows that by providing a general framework, you know, we can let the innovation happen by, you know, giving the power to our customers to really go, you know, develop the apps they need.
And so another question is, like you mentioned, like enterprise applications or enterprises a couple of times. Do you envision that, like, at some point, like, you know, consumers, like, you know, me at my home, you know, because a lot of the problems that you mentioned maybe are even more pressing for normal people, right, where
yes,
I don't know how to maintain my machines and so on. So
it could be, my feeling would be these would be great value-add services on top of our platform.
Yeah.
You know, like, this is an opportunity where I believe that our platform that we have built is going to be very attractive for startups. And because that's where the innovation happens. If you look at a startup, there are two things that matter to them. The first is they need a lot of capital, right,
yep,
if they have to start off, mm-hmm, and then how fast can they get to market, right? We take their capital worry away because they don't need any capital. They just pay as you use it, as you go. Pay, you know, so they can.
Sure.
So we can we take that worry out. The second element comes out is that how fast can they get? And by taking all the complexity away for them, like all these details about how you're going to update it, how you're going to manage it, we take all of those things away. Now they can focus on the class of on really the business logic of their apps and make them to the market. And I think that's a like the scenario that you're describing is a great startup idea.
Yeah.
Right? And somebody can write a service like that and manage the, you know, the various species and things like that, you know. And my feeling is we'll see a lot of those things emerging, I think our approach will be to provide them with lots of tools and basic services that they need that makes the construction of the examples, like you said, much, much easier.
So I got a question. Would you support, for example, if I were to create a service on Azure, mm-hmm. that was a service on Azure that I wanted other Azure users to use,
mm-hmm.
and I would monetize that.
Yes.
And so I would pay you a little bit, but then I would make a lot of money if people use my service.
Correct.
That's a model that we fully support.
That's right, exactly.
As a developer, I want to make
absolutely.
Money.
That's absolutely. I mean, that is the model. Yeah. Remember, it's a platform, and the platform, the value of a platform is, I mean, of course, we are in it to make money, but is it that you have to make more money?
Yeah.
Like, a successful platform enables others to make much more money.
Absolutely.
So the goal would be that you're an ISV or you develop your app, you run on it, and mm-hmm. your app is going to be used by thousands of people.
Mm-hmm.
And we don't have that right now, but you know, but bill on behalf, things like that. We're going to enable that, and our goal is to enable those customers to come out, and so that they can make more money.
And then Eric's going to have to come up with like a new UUDI. Remember these guys?
Yes.
Yeah. People are going to have to actually be able to. I want to point at the cloud and go, I want a service that does this.
Right. Yes.
And then I want it to be found, and I want to then pull down a proxy class, shove it into my application, and rock and roll.
Yeah.
Absolutely.
Well, on the other hand, I think, you know, that now the kind of, you know, I think the web itself has kind of, you know, grown a lot. So finding services, you know, I'm not so sure that you're going to really want to kind of have it in that kind of mechanical way. Right? Yeah. So another thing is like, you know, I mean, I'm really kind of, you know, ready to kind of, you know, start hacking on this, and in the good sense, of
yes.
course. but what do you know, the Niners have to do in order, if they want to play with Azure and all these things?
It's actually very simple. You know, like we announced at PDC that it's basically in CTP, the Community Technology Preview, so it's free. And all you do is you go to www.azure.com, mm-hmm. and there's a button there, and you say, you know, you want to join the CTP. We will get a token back, you know, fairly instantly if you don't send me mail. But but we are giving, you know, I mean, everybody's getting, we're giving a token out.
Sure.
You know, we've given out tens of thousands of tokens by now, and then you just go, and you can download the kit and develop a service and deploy it. We also have an SDK. That's actually another thing I should mention, which is very cool. And this is something that we actually used in developing Windows Azure itself. So we have what we call an SDK. An SDK is a complete emulation of the whole Windows Azure environment, the whole Red Dog environment. It's a complete there. So you can, on your laptop, develop your service. It's integrated with Visual Studio. Develop it and run it and test it on your laptop, okay? And so you can develop the whole thing, and once you are developed and testing it, the same bits that you are running and testing it can now be deployed on the cloud. So it uses the same thing, your service model, the whole thing. So we found it that it's actually not much fun trying to debug your service in the cloud. not, you know, like when you are running in the real environment, it crashes, it's not much fun. And a lot of our teams, which basically they did was they would love to run it on their desktop, and you can catch all kinds of errors because, I mean, there are timing errors and there are the different errors that you can go back and get. But certain class of errors, which are the easier ones, you can really go and find them, you know, on your machine very, very, very easily. And so we have a whole SDK that you can actually completely develop a service to do that. And that's actually completely free. So even if you don't log in or even don't get a token, you can get an SDK downloaded in, develop your service out, try it completely, the same environment on your desktop. And when you're done, press a button. It's not exactly press a button right now. It will be a press a button,
sure.
You know, eventually. But the goal is that you come back and you hit F7 and boom, it goes to the cloud.
Yeah, and I've used exactly this SDK, and I must say it's really cool. I mean, it is kind of, you know, very kind of painless to kind of, you know, develop and debug, you know, on your local machine, and then you deploy it on the real thing. So yes, that's it really works. I mean, even for kind of, you know.
Like, well, don't say it. You're not stupid. You're very smart.
No, I'm not kind of, you know, I'm not a specialist in this kind of, you know, area, right? I'm just a developer. I'm a .NET developer, and it just works. So that's kind of, you know.
So we have to ask one question here, because this is something that a lot of us talked about at PDC. We interviewed Manavir for the PDC. That was a very popular show and online interview. People want to know why, and you're the VP of this. Mm-hmm. So why did you name it Azure?
Actually, we had very little to do with Azure.
You like Red Dog, right?
I think Red Dog is such a cool name. I actually liked Red Dog. I thought it was like a really cool name. I think we may have had some other legal problems if we had called it Red Dog. But I think it's a really cool name. Once it's going outside, it's outside of anybody's hands.
Yes,
you know, it's where our marketing and our business machinery takes into play. But on the other hand, you know, there are focus groups, and there's a very scientific way on how we pick names.
Okay? Sure.
But Azure is also, you know, the color, the cloud, the blue, the tinge that comes out. So there is a rationale. It wasn't totally out of the blue, but
it's a beautiful color when you look out your window on a beautiful day, right?
Look at all those clouds.
And I think, you know, I think for a Microsoft name, it's actually quite nice.
It is.
It's not like Microsoft this and that for,
right.
You know, kind of one of those really boring names. So, and it's a beautiful color. I mean,
it
blue is.
Is
like, yeah, so it's...
It is, yeah, it is. And, but I like Red Dog.
I think Red Dog was a great name.
Yes.
But, I mean, it's all just people always ask. And then, of course, we had to spend a while figuring out how to pronounce it, right?
Yes, that's right.
Yeah.
Which has got, that's another problem.
Yes.
Once you get Azure, and then you go, you know, is it Azure, or is it this?
Yes.
Once you pick the name, then you have to figure out what, and then you have to get everybody to pronounce it the same way.
Yep.
It doesn't matter which one you use, but you got to make sure that everybody pronounces it the same way. We're still working on that.
Yeah. And it's, of course, you know, in the telephone directory, it starts with an A. So you find it first.
Nice.
You know? Yes, that's good. So, Charles, do you have any other questions?
Well, yeah. I mean, we got into this really fast. I'd like to learn a little bit about you. I mean, you're the vice president of Azure Services Platform. What's your story? I mean, how did you get into this?
So, the way I got into I'm not a services guy.
Mm.
I'm much more of a, you know, traditional packaged product, you know, person there. And this was towards when Vista was winding down, and I was kind of like thinking of whether I should go do the next version of, because I was busy changing the engineering process for Windows, and that was the time when Ray had just joined the company, and Steve B asked me to go, you know, like, why don't you talk to Ray? I mean, he was a little bit pushing, like, he wanted me to talk to Ray, and Ray and I chatted for about an hour. Actually, we had a meeting from 4 to 5, and we ended up talking till like 8 that evening. We lost track of time, and we kept on talking about it. And it was just kind of like, it was a very, very high level meeting, and it was more about, you know, what Ray was talking about, and, you know, how the world will go, and we were just like discussing all of those things out. I came out of the meeting, and I had three basically ideas there. One was like, this is very early on. Even though there are like a lot of people are established in services, they really aren't. Okay, it's like 5 minutes in the first quarter, you know, first of all. It's a little bit of chaos. Nobody really knows how the whole thing is going to evolve. The second piece which is there is there's a lot to be done. I mean, people are, you know, they're declaring victories by having some pieces. And they're good advances. I mean, we should not trivialize them. And they're really important advances showing the power of the cloud there. But there are a lot remains. For the full power, to utilize the full power of the cloud, there's a huge amount of value to be gained there, and the third thing was like, you know, it sounded like a cool set of problems. I mean, like,
sure.
It was like they were really hard problems, and I really didn't understand this whole space. So the first person I really came and talked with was basically Dave Cutler, and you know, I'm, you know, close to him, and first of all, he sort of like mildly interested or it was kind of like semi-retired at that point.
Sure.
And I didn't give up. I kept on talking with him, and then he got it. And then he got excited. And then we and I made a deal, and let's just go find out what really the problem is. And then we collected a few core set of people, and then we actually went and visited. There was all the services inside Microsoft.
Mm.
We even went and we visited the data centers. We did an ops for a day in the life or whatever, become an ops to really. So you really go and really understand. And that's why I was feeling so bad. God, if I had just known. I was sitting in Windows. I could have fixed that and made the life much better. Mm. I just didn't know. And we just went around and we just kept on talking to a lot of these the groups out. And the more we looked at it, it kept on telling us, showed us more and more that each of these services that we have over 200 of them, are written as silos. Everyone is worrying about the same set of problems over and over again. The lack of a platform, it was just like visibly available. If you look at the efficiencies we can gain was just like enormous. And that is one of the things that I will keep on saying is that if we did this whole Red Dog project, never for external use, just did it only for internal use, it would be worth it. That's the amount of savings that you basically can get.
Outstanding. I mean, I knew that Dave Cutler was working on what was then called Red Dog, and he's like, the master of ENT kernel.
Yes.
Right? Mr. Thread Scheduler. Yeah. He did some amazing rocket science work. And I would imagine he had something to do with like working on the hypervisor, modified.
Oh yes, I mean Dave is legendary, right? I mean, yeah. There is never going to be an engineer like him ever again. He did all of VMS. I mean, he writes code. He's just like a. I mean, for me, it's just a delight to be able to work with him. And I got a chance to work with him in Windows and over here. And he's just a remarkable person. And if you get somebody like him, and that's why when we put the vision out for what we wanted to do, and especially if you have somebody like Dave on it, hiring or recruiting people to work on this project was a piece of cake. could get anybody we wanted to work there. But it was a good project. I mean, it was good, and Dave was engaged, and it's been fun.
Absolutely.
So another question is way before you were in Windows, you were in research.
Yes, I was.
So my question is is there anything that you that you brought from your of time as a researcher into this project?
Oh, it did. That was a big switch. I mean, if you look at it, that even before I moved to Windows, it was the funniest one because my entire career of over 20 years has all been in research. And then suddenly I was... I'd never shipped a product before, and I was redesigning the engineering process of Windows. It was like a big step function to do that, but it was fun. I mean, it was really hard. It was fun, especially I think one of the things that research, in my opinion, teaches you is to deal with ambiguity, and that was the toughest one element in these projects that came out because this space is very, very ill defined,
mm-hmm.
We don't know what it is. I mean, people still don't agree on the word cloud. What does a service mean? I mean, the fundamental, even the language is not universally accepted. Forget the fact, even inside the company, if you forget about, across companies, we're still arguing about what this person means. And anytime I go to any of these conferences, you spend the first 15 minutes trying to understand what does the cloud mean, right? That's where the state of affairs are. So you're dealing with ambiguity, and a lot of those things which the research is. I mean, if you look at the people that I've got working on Red Dog, like Brad, Todd, a lot of these people are from research.
Yeah.
They were professors who came in, and so they could deal with it. We could use the cutting edge stuff, and I think the strong backgrounds in distributed computing was very important, and the biggest one was to change the mindset. And that was the most critical thing that you had to really we really had to do was to you had to get the packaged product mindset out and really start thinking about services which are 7x24. There is no hot fix. There is no sustained engineering. There is no SP1. When the life cycle goes down, all hands on deck. There is a very different engineering process. I mean, and a lot of our background has been in setting up engineering processes. So we had to completely rethink, what does an engineering process for services really mean to develop services which are supposed to be available and reliable and all the time, and they never go down, whether you do updates or things like that. I mean, it's an impressive vision, but realizing that, it's a fairly, very hard problem.
So I don't know if we have time, but can we talk a little bit about the kind of development process? For example, I mean, do your devs have, like, pagers, or, I mean, and do you still have, like, dev and tests, or can...
I mean, the biggest element that comes out, I'll give you some caveats to do the... You'll see this element comes out is that when you develop a service, when you deploy the service in a live site, you want it to work. So how do you make sure that the service is actually going to work on a live site? So people, what they do is they create an exact right replica of the cloud, and they first test it on that, and when it works on that, then they say you can deploy it on the cloud. But you can never create an exact replica. Okay, yeah. And so a lot of the times people will run it on the replica and it's working, but when they go down the cloud, they say, oh crap, you know, there's something was slightly different and it didn't work. So, and how do you solve the problem? The way you solve the problem is that out of the live cloud, you just partition some set of machines out and that's your test cluster. You just solve the problem in a way. So you go back and say, hey, I need 50 machines for testing. So think of testing and your development as just another service. Right. So if you look at all our developers that we have there, nobody owns any machines. It's a cloud. We have a development cloud. So if somebody comes in and he says, hey, I want to test I'm developing an app, he needs 20 machines, he gets 20 machines. I mean, that's our model, right? I mean, your service comes in and he says, I want 20 machines, we give you 20 machines. When you're done, you give the thing back to the pool. Mm-hmm. A developer comes in, he wants to develop a service, he says, developing this code there, he wants 50, 100, 150, whatever he wants, he gets it. He runs and tests whatever he wants. He's done. It goes back to the pool. The next guy comes in. He gets there. So it's dynamically shared among. So you are really using Red Dog in your own development.
Okay.
It's just beautiful. It's just beautiful. I mean, and you know, like the stuff there. For example, like if you look at our Fabric controller that we run, right? It's a Paxos cluster. So there's a leader. If a leader dies, then other guys quickly vote because and who the next leader is going to be, and they manage the thing out. One of the things we used to try in the development time was every 20 minutes we'll kill the leader and see the election happening very fast. If it doesn't, and my opinion was if it doesn't and the cluster goes down, guess what? The developers will not get their work done and they will go fix it.
That's the best incentive
to make sure it works reasonably well. It just changes the whole process out. Then the question comes back is that the cost people have to understand that if a failure, if you deploy something, or if you have not tested enough and you put something into the live site and you bring it down, the costs are extremely, extremely high. And so the testing process that you have to really put in place has to be very, very, very solid. And so that's why we have staging clusters and things. I mean, it's a pipeline piece there where, you know, you let it run for 2 days because the other problem that kills you in this environment is not only just the bugs that are there, but it's the timing issues.
Yes,
the concurrency is like out of the, you know, because it's a distributed environment, right? So a lot of those simulations, a lot of the timing and things like that, they're much, much difficult to emulate or work out. And so we haven't done that, but like, you know, the new classes of errors, I mean, you know, our background in static analysis and things like that, I mean, like race conditions and things like that, or concurrency issues become like way, way more important in those things there. And those are a lot of those areas have to be completely rethought. That become extremely important in this whole space. That's my point, was that this is very new,
absolutely.
And we are just beginning, to make advances into these areas. And our goal is that with the tools we provide, everything we're learning, we're making those same tools available to our developers. Mm-hmm. And as we make advances and we learn, we'll give it to our developers so that if we are doing well, they know how to do well, and we'll go from there.
Yeah. So since this is like a brave new world, do you have any kind of, you know, advice for, say, like researchers or maybe universities? Because, you know, the way I think, you know, we kind of teach computing is still kind of, you know, in the old world, right, where it is like, you know, you write like Hello World or sequential machine. So it's true. Yes. So
I would just say, like, the biggest one which is there is teach distributed computing. It's the biggest thing. I mean, like, I was almost to the point of by saying, like, you know, like, look, everybody thinks like a cloud app is different from like a regular app. I mean, it's not. I mean, you're still, if you want to use C#, you can use C#. You can use C++. You can use C++. It's not different. You can use the same language. it's a conceptual mental model that is different, right?
Yeah.
And how do you write a distributed app? For example, write stateless apps. Like, stateless is such an important factor that if I, there's one concept, if I could drill in every developer we hire, it's think stateless, right? It's so important in this distributed environment. I would really like to think that, you know, given this, all those things which are happening right now, that computer science 101 should be more of a distributed app course.
Yeah.
Not, you know, a regular Hello World course, but, you know, but the more the computer science, you know, the students, when they come out, you want to make sure that they have the distributed computing as a requirement, not as a specialization, which I think is more on that line.
Yeah.
At least when I was going there, it wasn't like everybody had to do distributed apps. But now, I mean, in my opinion, in this world, the way the cloud is working, all of the distributed principles, distributed computing principles, are becoming more of a necessity than an option anymore.
Absolutely.
Yeah.
Amazing. Well, this is a, I mean, thank you for your time.
No, thank you.
Yes. You know, this was very nice. Thank you.
Okay, great.
And I'm really looking forward to kind of, you know, where, you know, the cloud is everywhere. And it's like, you know,
totally.
I cannot wait.
Maybe
thank you very much.
Thanks a lot.
Yes.
Thank you.
Thank you very much.
Cheers.